My name's Emma Dawson. I'm the Executive Director at Per Capita, and thank you all for coming along today. With me on the panel this afternoon, we're very grateful to have world's former world's treasurer, I think, or best finance minister it was actually, wasn't it? But former treasurer Wayne Swan, MP, from Per Capita, my colleague Warwick Smith, who is the author of the report that you've all found on your chairs here today, and our esteemed fellow at Per Capita, Stephen Kokoulis. And I'm going to start by throwing to Mr. Swan to say a few words.
Okay, well, thanks very much. It's good to see so many people here. I've got the affliction of budget week, a slight cold, but I'll do my best and I'll try and keep my remarks relatively brief so we can have maximum interaction. I suppose I'll begin by saying that the Financial Review on Budget Day quoted a senior minister, who I think was Morrison, as saying this: "What Australia now needs is a wage breakout." And I thought, what? Senior government minister calling for a wage breakout. There was an element of truth in it, however. And the fact is that that since 2014, we've seen the application of what I call austerity economics, which has resulted in relatively weak and anemic growth in this country. And I don't think there's anything in this budget that really changes that. Now, a lot of material about the labour market has been distributed, but I've formed the conclusion that we are facing a jobs crunch, that our headline rate of unemployment disguises a dearth of good, well-paid jobs with good career outlooks. Now, I won't go through all the material, but essentially, underemployment is at record highs. Hours worked are at record lows. Wage growth is at record lows. And we can talk about some of the forecasts in the budget, which are, I think, a bit optimistic. So I want to make this point: you cannot have a strongly growing economy where a declining share of GDP goes to working people. You just can't have that. So I think our economy is bedeviled by the twin evils of pretty weak aggregate demand, but most particularly by a squeeze on low and middle income working people in this country. And the antidote to that should have been, at any time in the past 4 years, very substantial investment in productivity enhancing infrastructure. Now, the government has pretended in this budget that it's moved in that direction, but it hasn't really. In fact, their infrastructure spend is nothing like they've claimed, and I don't think it's going to have the impact on aggregate demand that we need. And the stagnation of incomes for low and middle income earners is reinforced by tax increases in that area as well. And the tax burden on low income earners has actually gone up reasonably substantially in recent years. Now, for Australia, this leads me to believe, and I've believed it for the last 4 years, that we need to be much more aggressive in our use of fiscal policy to boost investment and to boost demand. I've got to say, it warms my heart to see in this document a reference to one of my favourite documents, which is the 1945 White Paper on Full Employment, a copy of which I do have at home that I forgot to bring down. It's a reminder that in recent years across the developed world that fiscal policy has fallen into disrepair. There's been an excessive reliance upon monetary policy, and the consequence of that has been further inequality and lower global growth. And we've had not as a dramatic version of that here, but we've had some of that. And I think we need to be reinventing and reinvigorating the use of fiscal policy. And if anything lies at the heart of this document, I think it is basically that suggestion. The Chifley Research Centre produced a paper along these lines and talked about some of the big structural reforms that were required to achieve that. But I do share the objective of this paper that full employment is a core function and ought to always be a core function of government. But I also think, and there will be debate about this, that full employment, which I would define as somewhere around 4%, is perhaps the most fundamental thing that you need to deliver if you want stronger growth and a fairer society and higher social mobility. You can have all of the programs you like, but if you haven't got sufficient demand in an economy in the first place, then what specific programs always do is just recycle the problem in the absence of very strong demand. So our Chifley report, which we produced last year, used the term we need a high-pressure economy. What that really meant, it's a terrible term, but we do need relatively strong economic growth in the first place, because that's what brings discouraged workers back into the labour force and basically does something about lifting wages for people. So the first cab off the rank, from my point of view, for full employment is for the government to be more actively using fiscal policy, not just through investment in critical economic infrastructure, but investment in our human capital. The biggest deficit that we're leaving to our kids in this country is the deficit that's emerging when it comes to infrastructure investment and the failure to invest in education. And the backflip, for example, and I see Joe Ryan over the back over there, the backflip, so-called backflip on Gonski, is not anything of the sort. They now say they're committed to it, they just won't fund it. But yes, it's probably okay now. You know, the IMF can conclude that investing in infrastructure when interest rates are low is the most effective way to deliver growth. And in fact, it is more efficient than actually making the equivalent cuts in public spending for budget repair. But of course, our government here cannot acknowledge that. Now, just a word of warning. I don't necessarily see education and training as the solution to growth necessarily, or to the solution to growing inequality. It's an essential component of our response that we need to put in place for stronger growth and a fairer society. But unless you do something about demand in the economy, if your only response is just education and training, then you're just whistling in the graveyard if you think that that's going to actually deliver for the long term a fairer society and a stronger economy. So I'm a big fan of a series of structural reforms that we need to put in place for full employment, and they're pretty wide. A stronger voice for working people, a fair industrial relations system, investment in health and education, and in particular, a strongly progressive tax system are the foundations of putting in place stronger demand in the economy and moving towards full employment. Because what's happened in this economy is that there's been a breaking of the link, if you like, between labour productivity and wages. Yeah. And working people have been on the receiving end of that, the wrong side of all of that. Now, one final reminder. I don't happen to think that that you could have a fiscal policy which just says you spend anything you like any time. There's lots of ways we can spend and still have a decent fiscal policy and decent fiscal outcomes. You know, if just spending money was a solution here, then Costello's big government conservatism with record spending and record taxation would have delivered, and it didn't really. It's a question of how you actually put the mix in place, and that's why policies in the area of progressive taxation and so on can be used for budget repair as well as for greater equity as well as for stronger growth. And a classic example of that would be getting rid of negative gearing, just to name one. Just a point about the paper. There is a comment, and I'll finish here, that we in government had a deficit fetish and didn't keep our active fiscal policy going long enough. We had a huge tail on our stimulus package for which we were kicked around the country for not withdrawing. And no one seeks surpluses as an end in themselves, but you do need to have a fiscal policy which is appropriate for the times. And there is no sort of magic pudding that just enables you to continuously spend with no reference to prevailing economic conditions.
Thanks.
So, leave it at that.
Thanks, Wayne. I'm going And thank you for your endorsement of Warwick's report, which I'm going to ask Warwick to speak about a little bit now. He's produced the report that you all have on your chairs, which provides a brief history of unemployment policy in Australia, and I'll let Warwick talk about that a little bit.
Thanks, Emma. Well, I'm relieved that Wayne didn't agree with everything in the report. I feel like I would have been doing my job if it had been uncontroversial. I think the thing that stands out the most for me in looking at the history of unemployment policy in Australia is the shift from seeing unemployment as a collective responsibility to seeing it as an individual issue about employability. That 1945 white paper that Wayne mentioned spelled all of this out in very frank terms, that if we want the benefits of a market-based capitalist system, then we have to acknowledge what the costs are. And in a market-based capitalist system, there are winners and losers. And unemployment is one of the biggest signs of those losers. And if we want those benefits, then we should take responsibility for the fact that unemployment exists. And that's what the white paper did. The white paper committed the government to spending enough in the economy to keep the economy at full employment. So it was a direct statement about fiscal policy and how it can be used by government to maintain full employment. Now, all of that changed in the 1970s when economic rationalism really took over from Keynesian economic policy, and the economic rationalist thing is all about individual responsibility and the government backing away from intervention in the market. So that's where we sit today, is with this sort of dialogue about testing the unemployed for drug use or kicking them off the dole if they don't turn up to an interview for a job they were never going to get anyway, and about keeping them, you know, there's this sort of activity tests, which means keeping the unemployed running endlessly in a mouse wheel of kind of pointless activity when there's no acknowledgement that there are far more job seekers than there are jobs. Right, so it doesn't matter how, if we could animate all of those unemployed people today and get them all out there doing their absolute best, doing training, there aren't enough jobs for them. So some of them, no matter how animated they are going to remain unemployed. And we should acknowledge that, and we should collectively take responsibility for that. So I think that's a very brief potted summary of what's in the report. I don't want to take up too much time. We sort of want to have some back and forth and some conversation, so I'll let the report stand for itself.
I think I'm going to ask you, Stephen, now, you know, let's bring it into today and where we go from here. I mean, we've talked, both Wayne and Warwick mentioned the shift in the 1970s, and I think we saw the share of the GDP that went out as wages in the mid-70s was around about 58%, and as of last year it's 49%. Yep. At the same time, we've got significant unemployment rate, but significant underemployment rate as well. What do we do about it?
Look, and I think it's sort of building on Warwick and Wayne's comments too, there's been a seismic shift. And the issue with unemployment, I think, and it comes through in the research report, is that it's very difficult to fix it tomorrow. In fact, you can't. You can't. Unfortunately, it takes a long time, and it takes very proactive policies to make inroads. Meaningful inroads into unemployment. Yes, you can manage the cycle a bit, as Wayne did during the GFC, remarkably effectively, but it comes to issues about what the longer-run underlying drivers of high unemployment or low unemployment actually are, and you've obviously choose the policies that lower the unemployment rate. So, interestingly, if we sort of, and I'll sort of just pick a little bit on the back of what Warwick was sort of saying. If you remember in the 70s and 80s and even to the early 1990s, in Australia the average unemployment rate was about 8 or 9%, give or take. You know, it got a little bit higher sometimes, a bit lower sometimes, but it was about 8 or 9%. It was really, really high. From the early 2000s to today, it's been about 5 or 6%, give or take. It's occasionally been a bit up and a bit down, but you know, basically it's between 5 and 6%. So you've had a ratcheting lower in the unemployment rate. So why is it so? I think it might be the question. And one of the things that strikes me, and it fits into, again, all of the academic literature and all of the literature in here, is the skills and educational attainment of the workforce. If you think back to the 70s, only 30% of people finished Year 12. Yep. Only 30%. What a disgrace. 3% went to university. So, OK, that might have been OK when we were screwing on wheel nuts at the car factory in Geelong and these sorts of things. That's fine too. But we didn't have a highly skilled, highly educated, broadly educated and skilled workforce either. And then through the really progressive policies from the Whitlam government and then the Hawke-Keating years, high school retention rates went up to the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. University achievement went into the 20s and 30%. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have got these wonderful skills now. And lo and behold, our unemployment rate's lower. So, again, now they're seismic decade-long averages that I've been talking about, but it's one mini example of what you can do in terms of getting your unemployment rate down by undertaking policies from 10 and 20 years ago. So it comes to the point in the budget, and, again, Wayne touched on this, that, you know, bastardising the schools funding, discouraging people from going to university by hiking fees and making it harder and more expensive for them to go is exactly the policy that you shouldn't be pursuing right now, because the effect won't be felt tomorrow or the next day or the next year. In 10 and 20 years' time, in a dynamic global economy with robotics and technology and skills and all these wonderful things that are happening, you know, in 2030, are we going to be finding, gee, we wish we'd educated our young people to have these skills and, dare I say, the agility to be able to work within a very flexible labour market, but alas, we didn't fund them enough in Gonski funding, or and we discouraged many of them from going to university.
Yeah, no, it's an important point, and I'll forgive you for using the word agility. You didn't combine it with innovative, so it's okay.
I just had a brain freeze with that word. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I think, Wayne, going back to you, I mean, obviously, investment in skills and education is one part of the puzzle, but it's not everything. No,
it's not all. I think it's a very important part of the story, and it's very important to social mobility. But I just want to make the point that unless we can do something to substantially increase demand, then highly educated people are just not necessarily maximising their potential either, because you just get a recycling. What I'm most worried about, and I think what Stephen just said about our overall levels, is that we've done reasonably well, but the headline rate no longer reflects the reality of the modern labour market. 40% is casualised now. 40%. That is a stunning number. And those people are not always in the system, so they're the ones that are exploited and so on. So, you know, I think if you want to sort of adjust for that fact, I think our real rate of unemployment is far higher than the headline rate, and it's somewhere near the 8%, 2 million level. So, you know, I think we've got to come at it from that perspective and realise that if the worst comes from what is seen as the next wave of technological disruption, then we may also, which is the wave that people talk about actually moving through in all the professions, as opposed to just knocking out workers in manufacturing and so on. If that comes to pass, we may have the prospect of a longish period where the jobs that are created from technological change are far less than the jobs that are abolished. Now, that didn't happen post-war, but this did happen prior to the Depression. Mm. It happened dramatically over a long period of time. Mm. So my view is that, you know, we have to be watching this very closely. But given that capital has, for a whole variety of reasons in the last sort of decade or so, decided it doesn't want to invest long, necessarily, that what is driving our financial system is more short-term than long-term, we are now in a point in the economic cycle where governments are going to have to take a bigger lead. Yeah. Now, some people will say, oh, then they, but if I say that, they'll say, oh, so you just want to employ a whole lot more public servants. Well, we might have to employ more public servants, but it's not about that. I think when it comes to the big infrastructure projects, government is going to have to take the lead. I mean, our Clean Energy Finance Corporation that we set up is a classic example of how a government development bank effectively can work with the private sector to achieve social aims and substantially increased private sector investment. Its progress has been spectacular. We may just be in a period where government has to be bigger, has to be more assertive, and has to take a lead. We may actually be in a position where we do require a larger public sector if we're going to make the transition through a period where private capital has been unwilling to make the long-term investments and technological change, on the other hand, is not necessarily our friend in the short term. So the public sector, therefore, has to take the lead. When technological change comes, a lot of people make a lot of money out of it. The question is, all the people displaced don't necessarily see any of that. So in that sort of situation, what is required is much more assertive policies of progressive taxation, so that the productivity, which comes from the few who are the beneficiaries of the substantial technological change, is distributed more fairly throughout the population. So I think the notion of saying that at the core of our fiscal policy now is a belief that we need close to full employment. Now, whatever that means in terms of the way we measure full-time employment at the moment, or we go for a different measure. But with our current measure, I think four would be about around the area, that we might need a much more active role from government. And hanging off that is all the standard programs that are mentioned in here and others that we haven't necessarily discussed. But the outcome of having this aim of everyone being fully employed has to be a much more substantial role for government working with the private sector to deliver the demand and to spread the super profits.
Yep, absolutely.
Just to use a word that's come around the community.
I'll jump in there for a minute because I think Wayne just touched on an absolutely critical point. If we look at private sector capital expenditure as a share of GDP, it's about at the level now than it was at the depths of the early 90s recession. And it's not just mining, it's non-mining CapEx, private investment, is weak on any measure. And this is with interest rates at record lows, and with the economy still growing. You know, we're still expanding, albeit at a moderate pace. We haven't had... So that tells me a couple of things. The first one is that we're not having the private sector providing the infrastructure that we need. And the private sector does provide infrastructure. They build office towers and shopping centres and things like that, which are important for the economy. And they're clearly not doing much of that at the moment. As I said, it's back to recessionary sort of levels as a share of GDP. And then if you look at the public investment numbers, they're dismally weak as well. That we're sure there's a few little infrastructure projects going on at the state government level, and there are a couple of trinkets that are thrown in the budget on things that are acceptable and respectable. That's fine. But the worry is also that from the infrastructure side of the economy, that neither the private sector nor the public sector is doing it at the moment. And classic economics tells you that if the private sector is not doing it, it's the case for the public sector to come in to fill the void and do it quickly and easily.
Well, just to add to that, profitability of companies is at record highs.
Yes. Yep.
Yes.
The stock market, no matter how you look at it, is pretty high.
Yep.
Now, if that's not enough to actually get the jobs and growth that should come with, you know, private sector investment, I don't think, you know, dangling some corporate tax cut in front of people who don't pay any tax in the first place is going to necessarily result in any great change. There is a systemic problem, and it's not necessarily the fault of the private sector or business, that there is a reluctance to invest for the longer-term projects. That is very clear, and it's not just here, it's everywhere else. The incentives in the system mitigate against that. Changes of tax policy can have an impact there. Changes of regulatory policy can have an impact there. There needs to be a much more in-depth debate about the regulatory changes needed to put a framework in place where private sector investment actually plays the role it should be.
Yeah.
And that goes to corporate governance, it goes to executive pay, it goes to a whole host of areas that aren't on the agenda and ought to be on the agenda.
Well, I think this is what Paul Keating meant when he said neoliberalism had run up against its end point, really, wasn't it? That the old levers and relying on the market, it's not working. I think we need to reclaim that word distribution. I think it fell out of fashion, redistribution, for a long time, but it doesn't necessarily have to mean cash handouts. I mean, it can mean investing in skills training. It can mean investing in infrastructure.
But the wage system is the primary deliverer of pre-distribution. Yeah. And the wage system is, in fact, the one, you know, that are suffering the most.
Yeah.
You know, so as social democrats, we tend to sort of always view things through redistribution, and I'm up for a bit of that.
Mm.
But the fact is that it's what's happening in pre-distribution terms that is just as responsible for the weakness of what is going on. And the principal issue there is that workers are not getting the fair share of their productivity gains.
Yep.
That is very clear.
Yep.
And I don't know where we'd be as a country if we didn't have one of the world's highest minimum wages. Mm. You know, I think the whole wage system, world of work, power of workers, is a very big part of this story.
Yeah.
Because the balance has just tipped too far one way, and now we're living with the economic consequences.
Right.
Of the fact that the system enriches a lot of people,
enriches some people, and it
leaves a lot of people behind.
I mean, with the coming onslaught, as they say, of the fourth industrial revolution, automation, an increase in offshoring, robotics replacing jobs, I think you made a really strong point that we are going to see a period where we're probably going to see more jobs leave the economy than come into it. And this has happened before in the first industrial revolution, but government, it's the role of government to step in then and implement measures that will correct the balance back in the favour of working people. Warwick, you've referred to that in the report a couple of times.
I have, yeah. And I take issue with Stephen to some extent. He said we can't fix
this. It's not unusual for these two to disagree, by the way. It makes my life a lot of fun.
He said we can't fix it overnight. Well, in a way, it's a matter of priorities, right? There is a proposal, and there's been a lot of work done on this by people at the University of Newcastle, for a job guarantee. It just says, if you're unemployed and you want a job, the federal government will give you one. Well, that fixes the problem overnight. Now, of course, that's not a simple solution, and there's no pretense that it is. But that's at the extreme of the available options to us. And it goes right to the heart of what Wayne Swan was saying about targeted fiscal policy. That's as targeted as you get, right? You're spending the money employing people if you want to reduce unemployment. But, and I'm not necessarily advocating that's the direction we need to go in, but the capacity is there to do very targeted fiscal policy spending that really does reduce unemployment quite quickly. And there's, enormous breadth of options.
And in the last 20 years, I mean, there's some very good examples of good programs. I mean, the JET program was a classic years ago, where it was quite an expensive program, but it got a lot of women into work. I mean, so I'm in favour of active labour market programs. I'm in favour of funding them, but they're about that much of what is this big in my view. And because sometimes, we're very keen on the stuff that we can see and touch, doesn't mean to say that the broader settings are not more important. Now, if we don't get the broader settings right, then we're not going to make a guarantee work over time.
Yeah,
no,
sure.
We've got to have a situation where labour is rewarded fairly,
mm-hmm.
Capital, which invests long term and sustainably, gets a fair return. And then you say, once those things are operating fairly or well, where are we going to direct all those productivity gains? And I would say some form of job guarantee is the way to do it. But you've got to have all those other systems working well.
Mm.
Or what you'll end up at one end is a whole lot of people in make work programs. Mm. And at the other end, a lot of people who, many people who do well, and still a lot of people missing out. You've got to make sure your macroeconomic settings are actually going to enhance productivity and growth in your economy to drive the demand to keep the show going, to afford the job guarantee.
Yeah.
Of course. And I think, that's one of the things that leapt out from this research, was that the public conversation about this stuff was much more sophisticated and nuanced in 1945 than it is today, because they spoke about all of those things in the 1945 white paper. And, governments took on this responsibility for maintaining full employment, and then for more than 25 years they did it. For the 25 years after the Second World War and up into the 1970s, unemployment averaged below 2%.
In all developed countries around the world, which and it operated on a social compact.
Mm. That's right.
That's right.
And it wasn't until Thatcher and Reagan came along that you know, it all fell apart, and inequality is the consequence of that. Mm.
And we see that the legacy of those movements, in particularly in the US and the UK now, where there is a really big pool of working poor people, mm. particularly in the US, but in big pockets of the UK as well. I'm from the north of England, and that's absolutely true. And, you know, we refer in the paper to the fact that we didn't get into such egregious trouble here because we had mitigating measures in place. Fortunately, we had a Labor government in the 80s, and the Accord went a long way towards preventing a lot of those long-term inequalities really taking hold. I mean, Stephen, that's just on top of the GFC, which you mentioned earlier. Two examples of where Australia's charted a slightly... We've, you know, gone with the main zeitgeist, but slightly different course, and it's made a difference.
Well, I'd say it was dramatically different.
Dramatically different.
I mean, if you just take income growth, 1995 to 2012, median household income growth in Australia, 50%. In the US, zero. That's dramatically different.
Yeah. Yep. That dramatically different outcome from what, you know, were just slightly different approach slightly different in that we actually put some focus on supporting working people and jobs.
Yeah, and that was a really important part of how our economy is performing and how the labour market's performed. So there's these sort of other issues, and Wayne's quite right about a strongly growing economy, that we need growth to generate the employment that we need to get unemployment down and a decent wage paid to people. So, again, it's sort of... I don't mean to just bring it back to the budget the other day, but it's sort of topical in my mind, and I pre-wrote a couple of issues for per capita on this point. Yeah, framing a budget where your medium-term outlook is for the unemployment rate still to be 5.25%, and then acknowledging that we're never going to get it below 5.25%, and not mentioning unemployment in your budget speech, to me, smacks of someone who doesn't really care about it terribly much. It's sort of, I think, you know, the Conservatives would say, oh, it would be nice to get it lower, but we won't worry about it terribly much, whereas the reality is that if you actually just sort of look at their employment projections for 2020, it implies that there are still 800,000 people unemployed in 3 and 4 years' time.
And yet at the same time, they're relying on wage growth to return to service. Yeah. So how's that going to work?
And they're giving company tax cuts, which they think will generate employment or wage growth or something. I can't quite work out that logic. My economics
never did that.
I'm not just having a go at them for that sort of issue. But again, if you're looking at, okay, there is a business cycle, so you're dealing with a business cycle from time to time, but your end point after the business cycle either hurts you or helps you, your end point should be always aiming to reduce unemployment. I think that 4% target's a terrific one, but then again, you know, as in the paper here, wouldn't it be amazing if we got 2% unemployment? So why can't we do it? You know, well, what do we have to do to get it to 2? You know, to take a sort of a bit of an ambit claim, if you like, about how we actually can achieve such a clearly a beneficial for the economy and for everybody working in it.
We know 4 is achievable because we've got reasonably close to it in the past.
That's right. Yeah.
Correct.
Wouldn't the other side, though, say that then we're risking a massive wage blowout and inflation? And
that's what they want.
Yeah. Well, that's why
their budget would benefit,
But then you've got the issue of productivity. Okay, you've got to ensure that the economy, because we didn't have inflation breakout in the 50s and 60s. We had full employment with sustained low inflation, sustained high productivity. What was going on then, I wonder? You know, and again, it comes back to the government taking responsibility for managing the labour market within the business cycle as well. And other than this you know, crazy obsession about debt and deficit, which might be fading a bit, hopefully it is, that, you know, maybe we can refocus on those sorts of things and actually have the target, not a budget surplus, but have a target of low and declining unemployment, good jobs, decent wages.
Yep, sounds good to me. We might open it up and take a few questions. You've had your hand up for a while.
Yeah, Mike, doesn't the government have a very simple mechanism for getting wage breakout by supporting the ACTU's minimum wage claim and then rely on comparative wage justice to drive that percentage increase through the rest of the economy?
Well, they won't.
Or is that just too simple-minded?
It's too simple-minded for them. So there's no question that low wage growth is probably the single biggest problem in our economy right now. And the capacity of people to consume is constrained. So, but they're never going to acknowledge that. So if that's a central problem and they know it,
every step they take is actually to drive wages down.
You want demand-driven wages growth to come, and real wages growth linked to productivity. That's the desirable outcome from an economics perspective. So I think you a stronger economy. We haven't had 3% GDP growth for 5 years now.
I'll make this point. I mean, I just don't think you can turn around and say we're going to give everyone a wage rise, irrespective of what's going on in the economy. But if you lift demand in the economy, you lift the bargaining power of workers.
Correct, yes.
Right? And the thing that really crushes the bargaining power of workers isn't the headline, right? It's all these other measures. It's all the people wanting extra hours. That's where the exploitation's coming from. Poor people who can't get any work are being exploited by employers out there who know there's this whole pool of people that they can exploit. Mm. So strong demand, the most important thing about strong demand is it strengthens the hands of workers. And that's what you want. And then you put your framework then in it, whether it's bargaining or whatever collective agreements you're going to come to, whether enterprise or whether industry-wide or whatever, you have a framework for that because you do need sensible outcomes which bear some resemblance to economic reality. But a stronger demand across the board is what will strengthen the hand of workers, and that's what's missing, not just here, but right around the world. It's a principal cause of what's happened in the US. Yeah. You can plot inequality in the United States with the decline of the union movement.
Yep, absolutely.
It's exactly the same. And it's a bit different here because even though the union movement numbers came down, we managed to keep an industrial framework in place which actually didn't allow the American outcomes here.
Mm. That's right. Jim?
My question's to Warwick. Thank you. My question's to Warwick. I really love the comments at the end of the report, which is really focused on we've got to make the effort and we've got to make this a priority of government. Obviously, I like the fact you've picked up that big shift to price stability away from full employment. Through the golden age of post-war growth, we really had that very low unemployment and, for most of that period, relatively stable prices, with some exceptions.
Yep.
The thing that struck me when I looked at the white paper was really, in my view, a lot of the job growth that occurred came from the rapid industrialisation of the Australian economy around Second World War. And, Australia really didn't industrialise until then, until the post-war period. I suppose my question is to you, often we focus on the labour market exclusively, and I really agree we've got to be focusing at the macro level, how we're growing, but we also have to be thinking about economic structure and how our economy is creating enough jobs. I think some of the stuff that's really exciting that's happening in the resurgence of industry policy around kind of environmental issues in terms of reducing the carbon intensity of our economy is really exciting. In my view, it opens the door to industry policy to increase the jobs intensity of our economy. So if you admit it's important to reduce your carbon footprint, I think it's also important to increase your jobs intensity. I just wanted to ask you, in your researches, did you kind of come across any of that kind of, for 10 years, we couldn't really talk about industry policy. Did you look at that at all, or do you have any views on that? Those statements.
Yeah, I didn't look at it in any real depth with this report. But I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of ways in which we really need to transition our economy, and environmentally is the biggest and clearest one, with climate change, which didn't rate a mention at all in the budget speech. Wasn't mentioned. But there's a huge transition there, and there's also this looming transition that Wayne mentioned of technological change that's heading towards our shores, whether we like it or not. Driverless cars being the most obvious example. There won't be professional drivers in probably 10 years, maybe 15 years, but that's the kind of time frame in which hundreds of thousands of people in Australia will lose their jobs. But what we've got to be doing is thinking strategically about that and about industry policy and where those new jobs are going to come from. And in the past, and I agree with this generally, that this will be the same, that there'll be more jobs created, different jobs created that we don't know about now that will come out of this technological change. But we've got to be ready for that. We can't just sit back and say, I wonder what's going to turn up. we've got to be ready, and we've got to be thinking about kind of versatility in skills because the changes are going to come so fast. And we're not talking about that, and we're not thinking about it. But I think you're absolutely right about climate change. That's a big, big opportunity for job creation in this country.
But the whole clean energy package, with the emissions trading scheme and everything else that hung off it, was it industry policy?
Mm.
I know. It was right.
Yep.
No, but it's a classic example of what could be done.
That, did we? And it's amazing to see how much we got back in that game.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic we led on that. And there's, I suppose I'm just saying, there are more opportunities for us to broaden that out.
Sure.
Just have not just have the focus on the green angle, but have the focus on the jobs intensity angle.
Yeah.
When we're talking
Absolutely.
About how we format our economy, we don't just want to be growing jobs for white-collar workers. Yeah.
And the investment bank model that is the Clean Energy Finance Corporation can apply in any set of circumstances. It doesn't have to be in clean energy.
My overwhelming impression was, in one word, bollocks. I worked in the old CES, the Commonwealth Employment, and I was managed out in the late 1990s for whistleblowing on dodgy unemployment figures and their deadly effects, and labour market programs. So in that time, 25 years, I saw more labour market programs come and go, that it really was just a colossal, stunning waste of billions of dollars. All they did was churn a lucky few at the top of the unemployment queue into a job that was subsidised, and when the subsidy ended, they came back in at the bottom of the queue. And Maximilian Walsh, the economist, worked out that at the height of Working Nation, it cost about $88,000 to place one long-term unemployed, a year or more, into a job via a labour market program. So the second thing is, I don't think the panel members realise the massive harm they're doing by using the monthly unemployment figures as the basis of their analysis.
I don't use them. Oh, they're one part of a myriad of numbers.
This is more for Wayne, really.
Oh, okay. Right.
I mean, in 2013, you voted for not to increase the value of the dole, which hadn't been increased for a quarter of a century, and that lowers demand. You voted to offload sole parents on their pension once their child turned 8. And so many of those women, mainly women, ended up sleeping in cars, forced into prostitution, or committed suicide. And Centrelink have those figures. And finally, you voted for tightening up the DSP eligibility requirements. So the panel here, you must start to be honest with the Australian people, the plebs, the deplorables, such as me, and have a whole new approach to unemployment, which you've got in your envelope. And remember, President Trump, in the key Rust Belt states, hammered the point home time and time again, the real unemployment figure in the United States is between 20 and 25%. And he got the necessary votes and unfortunately became president. So I beg of you, be honest. Now, I know it's hard for some politicians, but be honest and start again with your analysis.
Thanks, Marcus, and we'll take that as a comment, I think, as
I'd
as
like
can
to
respond.
Leap to, I'd actually like to leap to Wayne's defence, because in his opening comments, he made that very point, that the sort of baseline unemployment rate is not the real unemployment rate, and it's actually much higher.
Mm.
He made that very point in his opening comments. So
but not in the Parliament. I'd like to ask the panel about some specific fiscal measures that would improve the quality of the unemployment market through the middle class. And you mentioned at the start of your opening, Wayne, that high-quality, middle-class, high-productivity jobs is what we're after. Yeah. But somewhere between job guarantees at the bottom and redistributive taxation for those who succeed in the future of the economy, we're left without a range of identified measures to make sure that what happened in America, which is no median wage rise for a quarter of a century, isn't our plight as we embark on radical change. So what are the specific things we can do to make sure our long-term investments in education and public and private long-term investments in capital and infrastructure result in a full spectrum of employment through a middle class that can flourish in Australia?
Sure, well, quality frameworks. I mean, not just any educational system, not just any spending. This is why, for example, Gonski's so important. You know, the Gonski agenda is a quality agenda for all. So getting those, getting the educational frameworks right, I don't think we can underestimate for this country the importance of very good infrastructure as both a driver of growth but also the key to the sustainability of the economy overall. I'm pretty optimistic about demand for the Australian economy because we're located in the right part of the world at the right time. So the truth is that if we get our systems right, we will be massive beneficiaries from the demand emerging from economies in Asia and the middle classes that come with it. What we have to do is to be smart enough to capture a decent share of that, and I think we can. Our universities are a classic example of how that is occurring right now. I mean, my city, people don't usually identify Brisbane as a university city, but it's more a university city than Melbourne. We have three massive universities that are exporting educational services. And that's just one example. I mean, I think the other one is environmental services. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the architecture or whatever. So our problem isn't going to be what many other countries have, is that they're just sitting there on their own and there really isn't anywhere to go. You know, the demand coming out of Asia is there for us to utilise for our own economic worth, but also, I think, for the stability of the region as well. The question is, do we get our domestic frameworks right to capture a decent share of that? And in that sense, I think, first of all, a decent wage system where people get rewarded properly is really important. The other one is progressive taxation. But the most fundamental reform that will help us deliver that is to do something about the power of big money in politics. Because neither of those things, in my view, are deliverable in this country unless we can get our democracy working much more effectively. Essentially, inequality is weakening our economy, it's poisoning our society, and big money is crowding out our democracy.
Yep.
So we're not going to be able to deliver the sort of structural reforms that are actually required to get the sort of economic model that Warwick is talking about, unless we actually get our democracy functioning much more effectively. And if it wasn't for what remains of the trade union movement, we'd already be down the American road right now. I mean, work choices would have been a complete 100% reality. As I say in my book, I think the most fundamental thing that that flushed a lot of these powerful corporates out and made them very much anti-Labor was our repeal of the fair of work choices. Then we came along and offered them a carbon price and a mining tax. They said, and we got a high minimum wage, we've got an industrial relations system, and these corporates, you know, operate around the world. And they say, well, why can't we do in Australia what we do in the US or what we do in Indonesia? I think we forget that our economy is now increasingly dominated by a small number of large companies. Five or six big mining companies, four big banks, dare I mention their names, a couple of big retailers, a couple of big insurers. So those people, I mean, I refer to this generally as the Trumpification of Australian business. You know, we've become such a wealthy country in the last sort of 20, 25 years that the people who've done the best out of it somehow think it was all done by them. And increasingly they then want a bigger say in our democratic outcomes and are prepared to throw their money around to achieve it. This isn't just about the economics that will deliver full employment. And it's Josh, about the political arrangements that will fight for it and keep it.
Yeah.
I'll be really quick, but Emma and I did write an alternative budget that was published on Tuesday, and one of the components in that, which is something that's dear to my heart about how you can grow the economy more rapidly, and in fact do it, this is the magic, or not the magic, it's the mathematics of this, one of the ideas is that it's revenue neutral, it doesn't cost the budget any money, and it was actually linked to some of the stuff on the inequality that Michael Cooney worked on last year. It's steepening the progressivity of the income tax structure. So I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but if you were to increase the income tax rates for those in the probably the upper third of the income scale, lift the tax-free threshold from 18,200 to say 25, and then you cut the next level. So it's revenue neutral. I said I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. Apologies. Then we know that the marginal propensity to consume of a billionaire, you give them another dollar, they don't even know they've got another dollar. It's nothing to them. You give a low and middle income person an extra dollar per week, they're going to spend that dollar. They will almost guaranteed to spend it. So what happens to your bottom line GDP growth rate? It goes up. What's the cost of the budget? You're taking $1 from the very, very well off, giving it to the less well off. Your rate of economic growth is faster in a revenue neutral way. So you actually have your demand lifted, you actually have your economy stronger. Yeah. So I just thought I'd chuck that in there.
I'm mindful of the time constraint. I'm going to throw over to...
Over here.
Okay.
Mary Sayers from the Victorian Council of Social Service. One of the things that you haven't talked about, which I'd be really interested in, is obviously the social economy. And we know with our ageing population, things like the NDIS, one of the fastest growing sectors will be the caring economy. Mm. And one of the challenges we have in the groundbreaking NDIS, which we support, as well as the aged care reforms, is we're going to a completely marketised environment.
Yes, totally.
completely marketised and unregulated environment, which is going to bring a whole lot of new players. We know it's not really a market, the NDIS, because the price is controlled and the price is at a very low rate, which undermines previous employment. So we're seeing whole new models emerge. So I'd just like some commentary on the social economy and what the future looks like there.
Well, I mean, I'm appalled by what I see emerging, and essentially with Julia and Jenny and Bill, I mean, we did the NDIS and we didn't outline a framework that was going to be taken, outsourced, privatised and all the rest of it. That's come along now. You know, I think the job market is a classic example of a gigantic failure in this area, possibly worse than the CES. and if I had my way, we would go back to a much more centralised model, whatever its drawbacks that were mentioned before. So the government has set out to destroy the NDIS. Mm-hmm. That's what's so regrettable about all their claims about wanting to save it and needing another Medicare levy. It was fully funded. But I know from what's been going on inside it that they're basically trying to starve it and privatise it and outsource it. And they just, for a while, they hoped it'll go away. So, there's a big fight over the NDIS that is yet to come. Mm. And it didn't stop what started on budget night. But the point you made more generally is the one that I was making before. We will need a larger public sector. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're level three public servants sitting in an office in sort of one of the cities. But they will be people out there helping deliver a service, and it could well be in a local community organisation. I'm also very wary of what I call corporatised welfare.
Yeah.
Some of the very large corporate welfare organisations can lose some of that locality and flexibility that is really required at local level. So I think there's a much more sophisticated conversation needs to be had about how we do deliver the services like the NDIS at a local level, not necessarily through some sort of outsourced for-profit model, but there may be another one which we haven't imagined. I'm sure there'll be a local organisation around the place who's got a model for us that we might want to...
And this is something actually that we're going to get into at per capita, because I'll put my cards on the table. I believe there are certain things, caring being one of them, that shouldn't be for-profit. We don't have for-profit schools. I don't know why we have for-profit aged care, disability care, early childhood education. That's, it's my view, and it's a long-held view. And it's something that we do a lot of social innovation work at per capita. We do a lot of work with community organisations. My predecessor in this role, David Hetherington, has just been going around the country on the People's Inquiry into Privatisation, and the strongest message he got by far was from the parents of adult children with severe disabilities who were terrified that their kids were going to be put into market-based, private, for-profit providers of disability care. So it's something that I think there are other solutions, and I think Wayne's right, there's a big fight still to come on the NDIS. You look at what this government's doing, they feign commitment to it and then they just chip away. And what can we pull out of this that'll feed the big end of town, because that's who actually likes us. I've done the same thing with the NBN, by the way, but don't get me started. Question over here.
Carl Fitzgerald from Prosper Australia. Just broadening the discussion, looking across the entire economy of land, labour and capital. And if we look back to the 70s, so the majority of bank lending went to small business. Now it's going to property. We've also got this other factor that if we do have higher wage growth, it will be capitalised into higher land prices. So how do we start building the discussion to deal with this facet of problems we have today?
Well, I mean, the speculation. Well, Stephen would probably be better on this, but the speculation in property, fed by negative gearing, is a classic example of where, you know, a government policy has been exploited by a very small group of people, and everyone's been a loser, including future home buyers. So, we are running relatively strong levels of population growth, which I support. I think Australia's greatest economic strength is its diversity. Mm. And that's going to be increasingly so. So we have to have the infrastructure that goes with it. And if the infrastructure is done correctly, then we don't necessarily get the spiralling land prices that you're talking about. But the absence of really attending to a lot of that critical infrastructure is behind that. But,
and any financial planner that you go to will tell you to take advantage of the tax breaks that are there and negative gear, even if you're on a relatively modest income, let alone people who are on very high incomes, and they're the ones that predominantly have 3 and 4 and 5 investment properties. So, as Wayne's touching on, it has been evident for some time now that the idea of negative gearing and the capital gains tax concessions that were there are now obsolete. They've well and truly passed their use-by date, and smart accountants are able to encourage people to get other people to pay the interest costs of people who negative gear, and that's just fundamentally got to change. It has to, and it will.
Did you want to?
Yeah, sure. I mean, all of our work at per capita and everything we do, cost of housing comes up all the time, right? As an issue for women at risk of poverty who we've been working with, for pensioners, we've just done a report on the adequacy age pension, and the cost of housing just comes up all the time. And the most disadvantaged in every group we come across are people who don't own their own homes. And, you know, we're pretty determined to make this a big area of work for per capita, the cost of housing. And, you know, negative gearing keeps coming up. But when you're negative gear, you're still losing money, right? It's only because of the capital gains that people negative gear. And the capital gains, it's not about houses gaining capital, right, value, it's about the land. Mm. So, and the owner of the land doesn't do anything to raise the value of that land. Why should they get the benefit? It's the community around them who increase the value of that land. It's population growth, it's infrastructure, right. It's all those things. And so, you know, why should you be able to just sit on a piece of land and wait and then reap all these benefits?
And the big failure in housing has been the failure of governments, including some of our state Labor governments, to really get knuckled down on social housing.
Yeah.
And not keeping land, which is located correctly, for the purposes of social housing and selling it off at huge profits has been an incredibly short-sighted approach by some state governments over a period of time. This is a classic area where public investment can make a huge difference, particularly to housing prices, to availability and to rents. And if I could name one area at the state government level, which is the most important progressive area for state Labor in the future, it's in social housing.
Couldn't agree more. There was a UN report came out in March, I think, that found that the greatest determining factor of inequality in advanced economies was those economies that treated housing as a wealth generator rather than a human shelter. And so it's something, as Warwick says, we'll be looking at more. We're running over. We're going to take one more question.
Yeah, sorry to jump in last. I'm losing my voice. I'm actually a redundant worker from 6 weeks ago from Hazel Power Station. So I'm pretty well aware of every topic you're talking about here. I'd probably like to touch on the housing. In the 1995, our houses, you could buy 3 houses in a row for $30,000 each.
Yeah.
Why? There's no jobs. So back to Wayne's comments. What I'd like to probably ask, I'm not sure how to frame it, is this. We've got the skills, we've got the training. We don't have the infrastructure. Now, we talk about the jobs and the green side of it. Well, we're all for that. The trouble is there is no replacement green jobs for our industries down there. Everyone talks about the solar. They're an installation job. They're not an ongoing job. I've been talking with people even like Adam Band about getting a molten salt thermal solar system in. Without the solar array, but using it with hydro or other contracts to heat. But there just doesn't seem to be any investment in infrastructure. Now, what I would say is in the industry, in the energy industry sector, the biggest problem I think we've got at the moment is they've got a monopoly, without a doubt. Everyone knows about the power problems in South Australia, but let's not fool ourselves. That's owned by Engie. That was Pelican Point System. They also own Hazel. They also own Loying B, of which they're selling shortly. So power prices don't look to be getting cheaper. Now, on the back of industry, that runs off. We've ran for decades off cheap power worldwide. We've lost that economic advantage. So in terms of jobs, I suppose, that's why I can't frame a question for you. But I'm sure the Cook or Wayne can probably follow up on that.
Thanks. Comments?
That's a dreadful story, but one which I think highlights something that, again, that we at Per Capita have worked on. It's not to say, and it's something that's a really pivotal public policy. And when we talk about education, when I talk about education, that's an all-encompassing term for skills and training for everybody, whether you're a kindergarten five-year-old or someone whose job's been made redundant in middle age. I'm not sure how old you are, but you know. Okay, there you go. So that's roughly middle. Anyway, but my point is that the education, skills and training sector does have to educate our preschoolers to read, write and add up and learn computers and goodness, coding or whatever those things are, you know, right through to school, right through to university, trades and everything, but also vitally, absolutely and utterly vitally. And we know that your experience is probably going to be felt by many other people over the next couple of decades with automation.
0.2% unemployment in
Moore. Can you say that again?
Jeez,
yeah.
In Morwell?
Yeah.
That's a three-month average from last...
Goodness, yeah. Goodness. Anyway, but I hate to say it, but we've got to be honest. Your experience will be felt by many other workers over the next decade or two as automation, robots and all these other things, driverless cars come along. All these things, yes. The question for public policy is, again, to... Well, apart from the obvious one of having a decent safety... welfare safety net so you can get by until you get your new job... is vitally important that skills and training are applied to you and everybody in the industries that are going to be redundant, unfortunately, so that you can find another job of similar skills. It doesn't mean that you're going to be retrained to become a rocket scientist or anything like that, but it's got to be the public sector providing the skills and training for you so that you've got a greater ability to think outside about what you might do. And I know that sounds... I don't mean to be patronising. In fact, on the contrary, I'm not. I'm deliberately not being that. But you've got to have a situation where everybody who wants a decent job can get a decent job. And if that requires the public sector to fund skills and training and retraining, that's the bottom line from my perspective.
I think that's right. I grew up in Moe, and I think it's the tragedy about the Latrobe Valley is if you look at the way that the whole valley started... back under the State Electricity Commission with John Monash. They built a model city in Yallourn for their workers. They had techie jobs for techies, tradie jobs for tradies. There were good TAFEs. There were local... And the community was strong. Unemployment was virtually non-existent. Those were all due to deliberate measures that were taken by the state at the time. Yeah.
550 premises every year back when I was first started.
Yep.
So that brings me back, I suppose, to Wayne in terms of infrastructure.
Yeah, and Bill said a lot about this last night.
He did.
Which I think one of the really refreshing compulsory requirement that 1 in 10 jobs in infrastructure were apprentices. So there does have to be a much more interventionist approach to this. If you were to look at where people worked 20 years ago in Australia, let alone 40, and then look now, the labour force is completely different. So trying to necessarily predict... where the job's going to be or who's going to get it and what the qualifications are is pretty hard. But you can be sure of one thing. Unless you've got your economy really starting to pump, then there's really no hope. You know, and so that's why I stress so much that we've got to have a series of policy settings which will make this economy really work. And it's not as if there aren't so many things that need to be done. Now, it mightn't be able to happen where you live, But as a nation, it ought to happen. And when I spoke before, the days of cheap energy aren't over. They're coming back. We've just been in this transition and you've been the victim of it. And the transition has been sort of handled appallingly.
Policy failure in the energy market.
That's it.
Yeah.
If someone put 1% in terms of that into the rent for a just transition, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Exactly.
Yep.
Correct.
Exactly. And it's not as if it wasn't known. That in fact, that was all in one day.
Sorry, Jack, but I do appreciate Labor had the climate change policy and they actually had the just transition clauses in there.
Yeah.
5 and 6.
Yeah.
I'm fully aware that Labor's done a lot in that area. So.
But on the back of the cheap energy that is going to come out of renewables, there will be a whole series of things that we don't even know about yet. but if you're not in there, you know, with a view about it and a plan, as you say, it's just hopeless.
This comes back to what I was saying right at the very beginning, which is that, you know, these transitions should be a shared responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not reasonable in any way to suggest that people who are made unemployed by these broad-scale transitions, it's their own problem.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. This is a shared problem. Should be.
It is. It should be, and we're certainly, I think, as a panel in furious agreement that you can't just leave people on the scrap heap, that, you know, if we want a just society, a fair society and a strong society economically with the underpinnings for growth in future, then we as a collective unit have to address these things. We're going to have to leave it there. We're way over time. Please join me in thanking Wayne Swan. My colleagues Warwick Smith and Stephen Koutoulis. I know a lot of you had questions that you didn't get to ask, so what I'm going to suggest is join Per Capita on Facebook or Twitter and we'll continue the conversation there. We love to hear from all of our Per Capita friends and family for policy ideas. These ideas don't come up on their own. That too is a collective responsibility. There are a few people that bought tickets for today through Eventbrite. I'm not talking to our invited guests. If you did and you haven't paid, can you see Alison at the end? Thank you in particular to our hosts here at CAUSE today. I'm very grateful to them for hosting us and putting on such a lovely lunch. So, Joseph, thank you. And thank you all for coming. This is the first event we've had in Melbourne for a while, but there will be more, so stay tuned and we hope to see you next time. Thanks.